Today's Teisho will be on case 9 in the collection known as Entangling Vines. Case 9 is entitled Zhao Zhou's Juniper Tree. A monk once asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" Zhao Zhou answered, "The juniper tree in front of the garden." The monk replied, "Master, don't teach me using external objects." Zhao Zhou said, "I'm not teaching you using external objects." The monk asked, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" Zhao Zhou answered, "The juniper tree in front of the garden." Afterward, Fayan Wenyi asked Zhue Tijui, "I heard that your teacher Zhao Zhou spoke of a juniper tree. Is this true?" Zhue Tijui replied, "My late teacher never said such a thing. Don't slander him." Fayan commented, "A true lion's cub gives a good lion's roar." This is a very famous koan. It appears in many different koan collections. Sometimes it's translated in English incorrectly. Sometimes the question here is, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And the answer is often translated as an oak tree in front of the garden, but it's actually a juniper tree. Some of you may know that Bodhidharma is the Indian monk who brought Zen to China. So Bodhidharma was a very accomplished meditation master, very respected in India, and in his 40s he left India to bring Chan, to bring Zen to China. And so the question, why did Bodhidharma come to the West, or what is the purpose of Bodhidharma's coming to China, is really a question about the heart of Zen practice. What is the essence of Zen practice? And the answer Zhao Zhou gives is the juniper tree or the cypress tree in the garden. Now this appears in a number of different koan collections, but this koan collection has a little bit extra, a little bit of a hint. So a monk once asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West, coming from India to China?" And Zhao Zhou answered, "The juniper tree in front of the garden." The monk replied, "Master, please don't teach me using external objects." This is a sort of a hint. You know, when people think about meditation practice, they often think of it in terms of... please see who's there. Are you here for Zen?
Yes, is that okay?
Yes, it is. I'm glad you came. You braved the elements, the snow, it's snowing out there, it's great. So this is a kind of a talk, special kind of talk, based on these collections of subjects for meditation in Zen. It's called Taisho. And the proper way to listen to a Taisho is to sort of balance your body on the cushion, watch your breath, and just sort of let the words drift by. If you hold on too tightly to the words, it's not a lecture, there's no quiz at the end. So you just want to listen and let it sort of soak in, and some of it will just drift by, and it doesn't really, you don't have to hold on too tightly, just let it go by. And your mind will pick out the things that it thinks are important. You have like we have like a superficial mind, right, which is sort of our conscious mind. And this is the mind that says, am I late? Should I knock at this door? But there's another mind that made you get up this morning and come here, right? And you probably didn't know what you were doing, but something inside you said, give it a try. What the heck? So that deeper mind is going to listen to this koan, discussion, and it's going to pick what it needs to have for its food. Okay, so just let your deeper mind feed on these words that are drifting by. Okay. So the subject of this talk today is a koan about a great Zen teacher. And a monk is asking about him and says, you know, why did Bodhidharma bring Zen to China? And basically the answer is the cypress tree in the courtyard, or the juniper tree in the courtyard. And the hint is that, you know, the student says, teacher, please don't teach me using external things. And I was saying that, you know, we normally think of meditation practice as something that is inward or inner, you know. So when we think about practice of Zen, you come in, you sit down on the cushion, you straighten your back, you breathe through your hara, and you might think of yourself as going inside. If you read books on meditation, they often talk about meditation as a kind of innerness or inwardness. And when you're in deep samadhi, you may sometimes feel, that you're deep inside yourself and the world is far away out there. This is very common. In other traditions of meditation too, meditation is often thought of as inner-directed, inward, and so on. You know, this is a very common way of thinking. So, you know, somebody might see you meditating and say, oh, you were deep inside yourself. You're going deep inside yourself. So meditation seems to be about withdrawing from the world and going deep inside ourselves. And when we're in deep concentration, the outer world may seem very, very far. You know, inner world, outer world. This is basic to the way we think sometimes, and it's even basic to our language. So we meditate on the cushion, we go deep inside ourselves. You know, after you have spent the morning meditating, say you came here and you did an hour of meditation and then you listened to this talk, after a period of meditation, you might go outside, and it might be a little jarring, you know, because, you know, in here, everything's quiet, we're meditating. Then you go outside, and maybe people are noisy. You know, we do these retreats in Zen called Sesshin, and I hope you'll have a chance to do some of them. You know, many people go to the Sesshin and we meditate for 5 days or 7 days. And we meditate 9 hours a day, believe it or not. You know, and at the end of the period, you know, we're all very calm, very grounded, very open. Then you get in your car and you drive down the Garden State Parkway and somebody cuts you off and there's a long line and people are honking And you can feel, oh, this is a little bit abrupt. It's a little bit of a discontinuity, you know, because inside you're calm, but outside it's not calm, see? So this boundary between inside and outside is something we we think of as obvious. It's obvious, right? And there is a certain truth to this way of thinking. So, you know, if you want to practice Zen, if you want to do Zen, you really need to create time and a place for practice. So, you know, you have to, if you're living with other people, you have to just say, listen, I'm going to go upstairs and I'm going to close the door and I'm going to just meditate. And you know, you have to sort of say goodbye to all of this stuff that's going on. Say goodbye to your friends, go up to your room, sit down on the cushion, ask them to be quiet, you know. And everything going on outside, it disappears, and you're very, very focused, you would say, on yourself, inside. So this is sort of part of the rhythm of Zen. You know, we go deep in ourselves, and the outer world withdraws. This makes some sense. And as I say, you know, if you're going to practice Zen, you sort of have to say goodbye sometimes to the people and the things around you. And this is really essential. You know, I try to meditate every day, and sometimes I meditate many hours a day. And when I'm in social gatherings, sometimes people know I do Zen, and they'll ask me, you know, they say, do you meditate? Yes, how often? Every day. They say, how often? And I say, well, sometimes I even meditate 2 hours. It's 2 hours. Oh my God! You know. And then you know, I'm not. I usually don't ask them this, but I could probably say, do you watch TV? Like, yes, how often? Every day? Every day. You know, how many hours? 2 hours? And then oh, 2 hours! So in our culture, it's not considered strange or bizarre to watch TV 2 hours a day. In fact, millions of Americans do it. If you say I meditate 2 hours a day, if I meditate 2 hours a day, this is like shocking. Like, you know, if I stood on my head, it couldn't be more strange, right? So these are cultural conventions. You know, if you want to practice Zen, you sort of have to say, okay, I'm not going to watch TV. I'm going to go and meditate. Or, you know, sometimes you don't go to the party. You know, sometimes I have if Sesshin is scheduled, you know, you don't go to the party. You go to Sesshin. Or sometimes you come to sit, you know, instead of doing something socially. This is part of the Zen life. So there is a kind of truth to this idea that we leave the outer world behind and go into ourselves. There is a kind of truth to that. You have to close the door. You have to say goodbye. You have to say, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to the party because we're having meditation, or I'm doing meditation that evening. And, you know, you make a place for this in your life. And it means sort of saying no sometimes to the things around you. So there is this truth, right? But you know, actually, it's a little more complicated than that. Because you have to say no to your culture if you want to do Zen. You have to sort of push it back. And you have to create a space for practice and a space for a different kind of life. And if you don't do this, you'll never wake up. You know, the Buddha left his family. He left his wife and his child to seek enlightenment. And this was like a scandal. This was totally unthinkable. In Asian cultures, to walk away from your family is like social death. It's absolutely never done. And our founder, the Buddha, did it. You know. And in a way, he's saying you have to say no to the culture you live in because there's a better way of life. And you have to push back and you have to make a kind of space, if only in yourself, to practice and live this other way. Okay, so that's true. But on the other hand, you know, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, you squeeze your hara, the breath goes out, and watch the next breath. Little by little, you know, you begin to undergo a change. You know, it doesn't happen every time you sit down, but if you do this a lot, it will happen with great regularity. You come into the Zen hall and you're distracted or you're anxious. You watch your breath and your mind begins to calm down, you know. The thoughts begin to be less compulsive or obsessive. And you begin to just be present with your breath, and the thoughts are drifting by, but they're not gripping you. It's like you're sitting next to a stream, but the stream is a little bit in the distance. So you're watching your breath, you watch this breath, you watch this breath, and your thoughts are no longer sort of driving you compulsively. You know, normally, people have no space between themselves and their thoughts. Yes? So, you know, actually, you know, most people just are driven from thought to thought, or the thoughts arise and they sweep you along. And as they sweep you along, they trigger emotional responses. So, you know, basically, most people identify very strongly with their thoughts. And if you ask yourself, what will be my next thought? What is my next thought going to be? You can't predict. See, we feel like we're in control of our thoughts. We think our thoughts are our true self. Yes? We say, you know, of course I'm my thoughts. But actually, you know, the thoughts arise uncontrollably. You can't predict what your next three thoughts will be. It's really like you're almost like a slave of your thoughts. They arise and you embrace them, and sometimes they trigger anxious reactions. So you might be sitting down having lunch and suddenly you think of your big test, and you think, I might fail the test, and then you think of other failures you've had in your life, and now your stomach is churning and you're anxious and fearful, you can't enjoy your lunch. This is typical human mental life. So, you know, in Zazen, we focus on the breath, and by watching the breath, we create a space between ourselves and our thoughts. So even though we continue to have thoughts, they don't grip us. We're not swept along by our thoughts. We see our thoughts arising, and we see our thoughts going. See, and we enter this stable, calm place, which, you know, feels like it's deep inside. And the thoughts are less gripping and less disturbing. And we feel grounded and centered and a little bit, you could say, almost like separate from everything. Separate from everything. So this is like a sort of a elementary state of samadhi, elementary state of deep concentration, where you feel grounded, imperturbable, and so on. But you know, actually, this is only a very preliminary state. You know, if you continue to practice Zen, you begin to notice that the boundary between Zen involves going into yourself. That's true. It involves withdrawing from the social world. It involves withdrawing from the world of the senses. So there is a sense in which we're going deep inside ourselves. But if you go deep inside yourself, one thing that you will notice eventually is that the boundary between yourself and the world begins to disappear. So if you've been meditating for, say, an evening, you come here on a Wednesday night or Friday night, and we meditate together for an hour and a half. At the end of the evening, you know, we serve tea and dates, or recently we've been serving dried persimmons. You know, so after quieting the mind for an hour and a half, you know, you have the tea, you have your dried persimmon, you drink the tea, and it's delicious. You think, oh my God, that tea is so good. You eat the dried persimmon or the dried date, and it's just so delicious. You know? Now, what is happening is that you're not experiencing things as separate from yourself. You know, you're beginning to experience things as simple as a glass of tea or a cup of tea and a date without this barrier between yourself and the world, see? Actually, you know, if you continue to practice Zen, you'll have many experiences like this where, you know, you'll get off the cushion and you'll walk outside and your mind is absolutely free of thoughts. And you'll see a tree, the leaves of a tree blowing in the wind, and you feel very much like you are the tree. It's like the distance between yourself and the world has disappeared. And these moments are quite memorable, and they happen to everybody who practices Zen. I remember having this experience very powerfully once. during a session, we all came out of the Zendo, and there was a full moon in the sky. And I looked at the moon, and I just felt as though I was 100% moon, you know. This experience of unification with the objects of our attention is really quite important in Zen, really quite important. Normally we imagine ourselves as separate from the world around us. And all the time, as we're going through our day, we're maintaining a kind of distance between ourselves and the world. This is not something we consciously do, but we do it unconsciously all the time. For me, some kinds of social settings are difficult. I'm basically a kind of a nerd or a bookworm, you know. So when I was a kid, I was happiest like reading in my room. And even now, you know, when I have to go into a meeting where there's a lot of people I don't know, or a party, you know, maybe there'll be a party at the dean's office, and I've been invited, I can barely drag myself over there, you know, especially if I don't know a lot of people. And I'll walk into the room, and I feel very distant, you know, from everybody around me. You know, I'm just sort of, I feel like I'm there maybe 10%, you know. And then I'll meet somebody I know, and now I feel like I'm there 30%, you know, or 40%. But I'm still a little bit separate. And I think we go through the day like this, you know. When I'm with my students, I'm probably present about 50 or 60%. But I'm never 100% present except in very rare situations. You know, you really have to be very open and very trusting to be 100% with the moment, you know? So usually we don't have that level of trust or that level of confidence. So we're 30%, 40%, 50%. But a lot of the time we're almost a little bit spaced out, you know, a little bit distant, you know, because that's how we protect ourselves. But in Zen practice, you know, that is not thought to be a reality. That condition of withdrawal or dissociation is actually thought to be a very unhealthy state, even though we spend so much of our time there to protect ourselves. You know, the truth is, we in Zen believe that these boundaries between the self and the world are really very arbitrary. They're not real. We construct them for pragmatic reasons, and we also construct them out of fear. So, in Zen practice, it is true. We have to withdraw from the world to some degree. You have to, you know, if the TV is on, if you have music on, if people are coming and going, you're not going to be able to meditate. You're just not. You have to close the door, turn off the TV, have a nice sound, relatively quiet room, you know. Sit down, and all distractions, you have to turn off your phone, you have to turn the computer off, or you know, and just watch your breath. It feels like withdrawal. It feels like withdrawing. But this is only one stage in a process, you know. So withdrawing is part of it. You know, going, we would say, deep into yourself. But actually, you know, when you go deep into yourself, what you discover is that there, you know, the self is really not isolated from anything around it. You know, when you're in this deep samadhi state, you sometimes encounter the world without barriers. And it can be thrilling, very exciting, even deeply emotionally wrenching. You know, my first Zen teacher was a Japanese monk named Takabayashi Genki Roshi. Takabayashi Genki. And his name Takabayashi means tall forest, which I thought was very poetic and beautiful. And he was a gardener, as a matter of fact. That's how he made his living. And he was a wonderful teacher in many, many ways. His teacher was a man named Soen Roshi, Soen Roshi. And at one time, I was the attendant to Genki Roshi. I was his personal attendant. So my job was to get his groceries and take care of him and do other things. And one day we were having breakfast together, and I asked him about Soen, and he was laughing about his teacher, whom he clearly loved very much. And he said Soen Roshi was a very strange man. At Sashin, when we eat our food, before we eat our food rather, we recite sutras, and we say. We honor the people who made the food, or we say we're eating this food in order to wake up. We recite sutras to make ourselves more mindful or more aware of what we're doing, to focus the mind on the act of eating. And sometimes, every once in a while, it works. We recite these sutras. We eat a little more slowly than usual, and every once in a while, especially because we've been doing a lot of zazen, you notice your food, you taste your food. If we've been doing a lot of zazen, sometimes you look down at your rice and you just feel like the rice is sacred, which it is. Well, anyway, Genki Roshi said that when he used to do sashin with, he said he was doing sashin with Soen Roshi, his teacher. And they were reciting the meal sutras, and he looked over and he said the tears were just streaming down Soen Roshi's face. And I believe it, because Soen Roshi was a very deeply awakened person. The boundary between ourself and the world is there often. We've created it to protect ourselves, but it makes us a little bit cold-hearted or closed up. And, we might be afraid of being too open because things might hurt us. But Soen Roshi was a really open person. Very, very open person. Sometimes no boundary between himself and other people, between himself and the world. Most people who knew him found that to be really liberating. Really liberating. We don't always have to do zazen to have this experience of connectedness or deep unification with the world around us. Sometimes it happens spontaneously. But when it does, I think it really changes our state of mind. The other day, we had a snow day, another snow day. And I had been meditating, and I got up and I went into another room and to look out the window, and the snow was coming down in these giant flakes very slowly, and the whole sky, you could almost see the snowflakes hanging in the air. So I just sat back down and started watching these snowflakes, and I felt myself just go deep into deep samadhi. It was a deeper sit watching the snowflakes than I'd had on the cushion. And I just think being fully present with the snowflakes put me in this very deeply connected and grounded state. And this is, from the Zen standpoint, a really healthy mental condition, right? That no boundary. Our oneness with the things around us is realized more or less deeply. And in Zen, this is thought to be really valuable, really this is a greater or a deeper understanding of who we are and what we are. We have, we have this boundary all the time that we carry around with us. And it affects us in many different ways. My wife is really loves animals, really loves animals. And I grew up on a military base, and And my parents moved around a lot. We had a dog, but we never had cats, you know. My wife is really into cats. If you ever meet my wife, you will discover this fact. And she has, we have, right now I think we have, let's see, we have one, two, three, four, I think we have five or six cats. Okay? I'm not even sure how many. And if you, in our house, there's different parts of the house belong to different cats, you know. So there's one or two cats that live in the basement, right? And they each have their own little area of the basement. And then there's another couple of cats, the brother and sister. And then there's Jaru's cat lives with us. And then there's another cat. So I think, what is that, six, five or six cats. And there's also a cat, there are cats outside that my wife feeds. You know. So, you know, I have heard in the newspaper, you read these stories about these women who all have like 30 cats living in their house, and it's terrifying to me, you know. All these cats, you know. At one point, at various points in our marriage, we've been down to just one or two cats, which would, for me, that would be perfect, right? Just a couple of cats. But my wife is like a cat magnet, you know? So stray cats just come to our house and they wind up inside our house. You know, this, for a while, this made me really nervous, and it drove me a little crazy, you know. But, you know, my wife is really deeply moved by these animals. I have learned a lot from my wife, you know, because I think she has, I'll come home and she'll be talking to her cats, you know, and she'll, ask some questions and she'll be talking to her cats, and she's very intelligent person, so, and she's not crazy or anything. She just relates to these cats as though they were people, you know, almost. She'll talk to them, say, "What would you like for dinner?" You know, and I don't know what the cat is supposed to say. I know, and she'll, you know, I could go on and on with stories about my wife and her cats. For a while, this drove me crazy, or it bothered me. It made me afraid, you know, made me nervous. But, you know, really, it's a very deep way of life. You know, animals are not really fundamentally different from us. You know, they're really not. You know, you can say, well, they're not as intelligent as we are. You know, cat, if we test a cat out and a human out, we give them a IQ test, you know, the human will do so much better than the cat. This is really not a Zen way of looking at the situation. Now, the Zen view would be that's a very alienated, very a detached view, right? Now, when you're sitting down on your cushion and your cat comes up to you, you know, if you're in deep samadhi, you realize, I am the cat. I am the cat. You know, this is not a philosophical statement. It's not a moral statement. It's a statement of how reality seems when you're in a more awakened condition. You know, I am the cat. See? You know, the Zen teaching is that when you feel separate from something, you are not in your right mind. That's a Zen teaching. The Zen teaching is if you feel separate from something, you are not awake. When are you awake? When you feel that the other is yourself. The other is yourself. Now, this is a very difficult condition to achieve and sustain, but it's, from the Zen standpoint, reality is everything is my true self. Everything is my true self. One of the people in our group came to see me one day, and she had been meditating very deeply, and she said, you know, I think she was walking down the street, I think, and she said, I saw this other face, and she said, for a minute, I felt it was my face. See, now Zen would say that is sanity. That is actual sanity. Insanity is where you feel very alienated from everything around you. So, you know, will never forget, you know, my wife adopts these cats who are out on the street, and she brings them home, and she takes care of them. And these poor cats have had such a terrible life. You know, she had this one cat that she found on the street, and his ears had actually been deformed from frostbite, you know. So he had these little crinkled ears. That poor cat had been out in the snow and the cold, you know. And she gave him such a good life, you know. And I really think my wife is a wonderful person. And I actually think what she's doing when she helps these animals in distress is really basically sane, basic sanity. I think on some level, you know, she has this deep sense of connection with these animals, and I think the Zen standpoint is this is basic sanity. What's not sane is feeling separate. You know, so if you look at what humans have done, you know, to the natural world in general, it's quite shocking and totally unnecessary. You know, but it's a function of our, you could say, our mental illness. You know, our mental illness. You know, we Zen people believe, you know, the tree is my true self. You know, the cat is my true self. You know, so we have a very different attitude towards the world than is the conventional attitude today. You know, this idea that, you know, there are actually people in the world who truly believe that the world is their true self. Not just Zen people. You know, there's people living in other cultures who really see, like, you know, the mountain as their mother, the earth as their body. You know, this sounds very abstract, very metaphysical. But actually, as I say, you know, if you enter the proper state of mind, you experience the world as yourself. And the thing that arises when you're in that state is this powerful sense of compassion, or this powerful desire to protect and take care of. See, these things all go together. You know, when I started training with Genki Roshi, I was sort of a hippie. I was a hippie, not sort of a hippie. I was a hippie. And I would get up in the morning and I would put on my clothes and I would go out and I would never think twice about, you know, I would take my shirt off when it was dirty and throw it on the ground. I would, you know, when we were going to meditate, we would go to the place where we held meditation. I would just toss my shoes down and throw my socks on top of them and move on. Once I was at a sesshin, and Genki Roshi saw all these shoes. Most of his students were like me, you know. There was a place where we were supposed to put our shoes, and we would just pile them in a big pile. We'd just throw our shoes off, and there'd just be like a pile of shoes. And Genki Roshi was walking by, and he stopped, and he started organizing the shoes. And he put all of the shoes, like in pairs, very neatly against the wall. And he put the socks, you know, this took like, you know, a number of, it took a little while for him to do it. He got them all in a row. And I didn't understand this at all. I thought, you know, this seemed kind of authoritarian to me. Like, what's wrong with just casually tossing your shoes down? But he said, you are the shoes. You know, you behave as though these are yourself. And it took me years and years to understand this. You know, I just thought this was a fantasy or some kind of Japanese thing, you know. But, you know, I'm quite convinced that Genki lived a lot of his life in this spirit of connectedness and also, like, caring and compassion, you know. So it might be true that cats don't have the same IQ as we do, you know, but they are still our true self. And we have a very alienated and mechanical understanding of life. We do. Our culture has spent 1,000 years taking us away from what Zen would call reality. And it has put us in a place where we feel like strangers all the time, and where we have a mechanical interaction with the world. We look at the world as raw material, or we look at the world as something we can manipulate. It's very separate. But the Zen view is that this is a tremendously unhealthy mental outlook. They're tremendously unhealthy. A healthy person is constantly working to dissolve the boundary between himself or herself and the world. And when that boundary dissolves, there's this deep sense of loving kindness or compassion or the desire to take care of, you know. And when that arises, you know you're in a mentally healthy place, where when your motive is protecting and caring for the other. So we have this. This is not our normal cultural value, you know. I was raised to think shoes are just a material thing. But actually, when we begin to think that way, everything becomes just a material object that we can manipulate, even our own bodies. So, it's very common for people to manipulate things, treat things as lifeless objects. It's common for us, if we are not careful, to treat other people as lifeless objects. We do this all the time. It's possible even to treat ourselves as lifeless objects, you know, and we do this all the time, you know. A number of years ago, there's a person who's no longer in this group, who was only here very briefly, who was, you know, suffering in a lot of ways. This person had anorexia issues, you know, and also cutting issues, you know. Cutting. You know, some people actually cut themselves, you know. You have to ask yourself, how does that mindset get created where people are, they hate their own bodies, right? Hate their own bodies, you know. And they're looking at themselves all the time, like in a mirror, as though, you know, they are... as though they're strangers. Their own bodies are strangers, or their own bodies are separate from themselves, you know. But this mentality is deeply ingrained in our culture, Our culture has many good things too, so I'm not saying we're terrible in every respect, but we have an unhealthy attitude towards ourselves and towards the world because we see ourselves as basically separate. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, and we meditate, you know, part of that is becoming, first of all, becoming one with our own bodies, which is sometimes challenging for people, you know. You know, if you're sitting in a chair and you're sitting in a very padded chair, you're not necessarily encountering your body, you know. Your body is sort of invisible to you. When you sit down on the cushion, you know, your body is much more present. You can feel your body. You have to keep your back straight. You have to breathe with your abdomen. And, you know, we try to control our body and make it do what we want, but we can't really control our body. Sometimes your legs are going to hurt. You know, sometimes your back... the other day I was shoveling snow, and the snow was very heavy. So today when I was sitting, the small of my back, about three sits in, was really screaming. I can't control that, you know. I tried to command it to go away. Go away. But it didn't go away. You know, it still hurt. But you have to be with your body if you meditate. You have to accept your body. You have to be fully present in your body with your breath. You know, and so you're entering into a different relationship with your body. You know, when you meditate, you're really letting the body be the master. You know, really. You're letting the body take over. It's not like we're using the body as a machine. We're actually letting the body be the boss. Letting the body be the teacher. See? So it's a different relationship to the body. We become one with the body by watching the breath. And normally, you know, actually normally, we're like a million miles from our bodies. You know, we're glued onto the internet, and you know, we might eat and we might not eat, and we don't remember what we ate. You know, people are eating while they're watching TV. They're eating while they're online. You know, and that food is tasteless. It's like they almost have no body. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, you're really accepting your body as yourself. This is my true nature, this body. And this is difficult to do because sometimes we're sick, sometimes we're, you know, we're not feeling 100%, you have an upset stomach. But doing meditation means becoming present with this body. Yeah? And it's wonderful, wonderful opportunity, because when we do that, we enter deep samadhi. When we do our Zen practice, it's true, it does involve something like going into our cells, but actually there is no going into the self. The boundary between the self and the world is actually an illusion. Everything is my true self. Everything is, this sounds like science fiction, yeah? But this is, you take it one step at a time, right? Take it one step at a time. Living with the body on the cushion is the beginning of Zen practice, you know? And then one day you get off the cushion and you walk outside and you feel that you're connected to the world around you. And this is like basic sanity. You know, we all have this, I think, this deep desire to be connected. You know, people who live in the same place for a long time, get very close to this. When my wife's parents were getting too ill to live by themselves, I spent a couple weeks one summer, and I was helping them pack up so they could move out. And they had lived in this house for 40 years. You know, they were sad to be leaving, but also, you know, the house felt to them so intimate, so much part of who they were, you know. My wife's mother, Shirley, would walk through these rooms, and she, you know, there were so many memories. You know, I can imagine, I don't know if she really did it, but I can see her hands running over the wall, the same way your hands would run over your own arm, you know. This was her world. This was her house, her home, her world. That feeling of connectedness or intimacy is a healthy mental state. You know, and Zen is all about cultivating that deep sense of connectedness, so that, you know, wherever we are can be felt as like our body, our home. So, you know, this is the point of the koan about the tree in the courtyard, the juniper tree in the courtyard. You know, how separate do you feel, you know, from other people, from other things? And most of us feel separate most of the time. And that's just a measure of our mental state, right? This mental state of alienation or separation. You know, every once in a while, we dissolve that boundary and we feel so intensely alive. It's like the world is our life. You know, if you're a writer, you know, you sometimes get that writing. You know, you're sitting in front of your word processor, straining and straining, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're just in the flow of your thoughts and it all unfolds, and you get off the cushion or off the chair and you just feel so alive. You know, it can happen while you're jogging, but it can happen if you're an artist. You know, sometimes you're painting or you're making music and it just connects. You know, you just become one with the music or one with this process. But this is really the heart of Zen practice as well, this becoming one with. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to the West? What is the meaning of Zen?" When we think about enlightenment, you know, we think about enlightenment as a kind of transcendental state. Transcendental state. You know, where everything disappears and you're, you know, in this other world or this other condition. You know, this is quite far from the reality of awakening. But this is what the monk is thinking. You know, what is enlightenment? You know, and he's waiting for Zhao Zhou to say something, you know, that will lift him to another realm, lift him to another planet or another dimension. You know, people really think that way. You know, if they meditate, you're going to meditate and you're going to go to another dimension. Zhao Zhou says, no, it's not like that. That's completely mistaken. See, you don't need to go to another planet or another dimension. You don't need to become a disembodied spirit. You know, Zhao Zhou says, be one with the juniper tree in the garden. And the monk says, Master, don't teach me using external objects. Zhao Zhou says, there is nothing outside yourself. The belief that things are outside yourself is already the illness you need to overcome. The monk asked, what is the meaning? He asked again, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Zhao Zhou answered, the juniper tree in front of the garden. Afterward, Fei Yan, Wen Yi, asked Zhui, Ti Zhui, I heard your teacher Zhao Zhou spoke of a juniper tree. Is that true? And Zhui Tui Ji says, forget about the tree. That's yesterday. Be one with what's happening right now. See, that's what he's really saying. He said, forget the tree. Who cares about the tree? There's not a tree in this room. Be present with what's happening now. And Feiyan, who was also a great Zen master, said, good answer. See, he said, a true lion's cub gives a good lion's roar.